When a stuntman on a film set gives you advice on how best to land if you're ever hit by a car, is it not something you'd ever imagine actually needing that information at some stage in your life? For acclaimed screenwriter and director, you can hear him, Mark Lamprell, this piece of advice actually turned out to be a lifesaver. And also serves as the opening scene in his debut novel, The Full Ridiculous. Getting hit by a car becomes the catalyst for a catastrophic midlife crisis for his character, Michael O'Dell. It's a story where a man finds himself playing the main part in effectively a tragicomedy of his life as it crumbles. But sometimes you can't pull yourself together until you've completely fallen apart, and boy, is it a story and a half. And yep. Mark, and I won't call you Michael, joins me on the program. Hi.
Thanks very much for having me, Natasha.
I mean, I did laugh at this, but it's really poignant too, this story. And it starts with Michael being knocked down by a car, lying flat on his back and looking around at the shoes of the people who have gathered to try and see if he's alive. This happened to you though, didn't it?
Yes, it did. And I have to say, it's sort of the poignant aspect, not the funny aspect, that inspired me to write the book in the first place, I guess. I went through a period where sort of it was kicked off by being run over by a car and being quite badly hurt, and seemed to spiral into this kind of chaotic period of my life for about a year where everything that could go wrong did go wrong. It was like the fates were conspiring against me. And I fell down and I didn't know how I was going to get back up again. And when eventually I did get back up, I guess I looked around and realised that actually that's quite a common experience. A lot of people have their own annus horribilis. I mean, not exactly like mine, but certainly quite similar in many ways. And it seemed like really fertile ground for a novel. So it was that idea, I guess, that inspired me to write.
You did actually take the advice of the stuntman.
Oh, indeed.
And
that actually happened to me. I mean, I did. It's amazing what happens. And I've spoken to a few people that have been run over by cars, and we've all reported this same thing, where time does slow. It is, you know how they sort of say that in the movies. Well, it's actually true. Time slowed, and I remembered, and in fact, it was in fact a Mad Max stuntman from Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome 20 years previously saying to me, I was asking him how you survive when you get hit by a car. And he said the big trick is to go over, not under. And he sort of even showed me how to sort of do it, how to lift yourself up and try and slide over the top of the car. And I actually remembered that in the milliseconds before I was hit. And I think managed to do that, managed to actually get myself in the air so that I slid up over the car, smashed into the windscreen and then catapulted through the air, but sort of landed away from the car and wasn't actually run over by it, if you know what I mean.
Incredible.
Yeah.
It is a catalyst for your character Michael's kind of descent into the pits of chaos and hell, really.
Yeah, and yet it's all very ordinary hell. You know, all of the things that happen to Michael are just kind of fairly unremarkable domestic things, really. And in isolation, they're probably all things that anyone could deal with. What interested me was that sometimes life just lines them up one after the other so that you can never get back on your feet again, you know, and it takes a long time to sort of recover from that.
Well, it was sort of more what was happening as much to him as to the members of his family that particular year. You know, describe his situation, and it's not exactly your situation at all, is it? You've used your fictional license to...
Yeah, it was an interesting thing. I kind of needed to create an avatar of me to tell this story. I knew if I tried to sort of write this as a memoir as opposed to fiction, I would be too busy protecting myself. I was quite frankly embarrassed by my response to the accident. I felt like I moved very quickly into post-traumatic stress disorder, and I kept thinking there are people in the world who are far worse off than you. Snap to get over it. And I kept berating myself about that, I think to the detriment of my own recovery. But
I want to come back to that.
Yeah. But it was really the notion that if I was going to tell this story, I needed to create an avatar. But essentially that avatar family that went through pretty much what our family went through, or very kind of parallel experiences. As an individual, having something bad happen to you, of course, in a family, particularly if you're in a close family, which we are, you're connected to everybody else. So it's about the team, really, and how that... So one of the big effects of it for me was that I brought the team down with me. You know, like I seemed to descend into chaos, and the whole team came down in a horribly spectacular fashion.
Well, although there, in the book at least, Michael's chaos, his family chaos, it's their making too. I mean, his daughter Rosie is,
Yeah, Rosie punches out a schoolmate and sort of Declan's found with drugs under the bed and all these. But they're small events, but then suddenly a policeman gets involved who, you know, stitches the two together, and he's a complete nutter. And
he is, you know, he is a nutter. Everyone needs a Constable Lancer, Johnston, to really remind yourself of the nutters in the, well, not nutters, but, you know, to really test you.
Yeah. But we did have a nutter like that in our life, you know, and it was actually quite fascinating having to deal with that as well, and trying to, and of course it's the when you're so vulnerable and you're scrambling to sort of fix yourself up anyway, and is the time when you are least prepared to deal with somebody like that.
Well, he was a corrupt policeman.
Yeah.
Effectively.
Yeah.
But in terms of your own, you mentioned post-traumatic stress disorder before.
Hmm.
It was someone else that picked it up in you, wasn't it? It was other people's observation of what was going on for you after that accident.
In my real life, and it's slightly different from in the book, but in my real life what happened was I was working with Andy Lloyd-James, who is a producer, and his wife, Trish, is a doctor, and she's a very fine doctor. And she was observing me just coming and going and working with Andy, and she said, "How are you going?" one day, pulled me aside, and I said, "Oh, you know, I'm fine." And she said, "You're not, are you?" And I said, "No." She said, "You've actually got post-traumatic stress disorder, and I can see it, and you need help, and I can recommend a psychiatrist, and go and see him, please." And it was fantastic. It was just great to have that, somebody with clarity. I mean, I'm sure if you'd asked my wife, Clay, she would have said, "Yeah, he's got post-traumatic..."
What were the signs? What were the signs for her and then for you?
Oh, look, I began to shut down. I mean, I couldn't cope with the simplest thing, the simplest decision about, you know, whether to have a Vegemite on toast or not. You know, there are classic things with post-traumatic stress where you just can't deal with sort of simple kind of dilemmas. And you just lose interest in absolutely everything. I couldn't read a book. I couldn't watch a television show. I couldn't concentrate. I felt despair. I woke up every morning wishing I was dead, which was a terrible thing to do. And even I knew you've got to do something about this. You can't, you know, the solution isn't to die. That's just not a good one. You've got teenage kids and a family to support and, a wife to love and the love of your wife and all those things, you know. So I knew it wasn't, intellectually I knew it wasn't a good solution, but all I wanted in my heart was to die.
Michael has that loop in his brain too, doesn't he?
Yeah.
It's a sort of rehearsal that this is somehow the second half of his life, but it's the end of his life.
Yes, well, and that's a thing that happens to Michael in the book. He has this conviction that the good part of his life is over and the bad part has begun, and it's sort of like this voice that like a monster almost that reappears to him through the book. And that actually did happen to me, this terrible kind of conviction that my life had been great up until now, and now it was going to be terrible. I was sort of almost paying for all that had been good. You know, I guess it was a very kind of Catholic way of thinking. Somehow I was sort of suffering for all my, you know, all my happiness,
and
now I was paying for all my sins.
The sin of pleasure, the sin of happiness.
Yeah.
Oh, that's tragic, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Zorba the Greek keeps making a cameo in this novel.
Yeah, Zorba the Greek, Zorba the Greek is was kind of a
great philosophical tale.
Yeah, it's a great philosophical tale. I love Zorba. I love his spirit and his energy, and, you know, he's just one of the great characters of literature for me. And even though a lot of people, you know, a kind of a post-feminist reading of it, he's sort of quite misogynistic and all those sorts of things. I mean, I don't really go there with it. I just go to the spirit of it, and that amazing, the thing that I learned from Zorba was the power of failure. You know, in the book, you know, in Zorba the book, they build this great contraption to move the timber, and they've spent all their energy and savings and everything on it, and it collapses and they lose everything. And his response to that is to go, or his friend's response is to go dancing down the beach and just sort of celebrate his freedom. You know, and to me, it taught me a lot about dealing with failure and having the courage to set yourself up to fail, because it's sort of in those very dark moments that you really kind of discover who you are and what your mettle is, and that can be incredibly liberating.
But for you, it was a car crash that caused you to crash.
Yeah.
And it's that trigger sometimes, isn't it? Despite the kind of love that's radiating around you in your home, it was that kind of car crash.
Yeah, it was interesting because really I have led a very fortunate life, and in a sense, you know, I do have great kids and a wonderful wife and a very happy relationship, and I've always felt, you know, and a wonderful family. My parents were terrific kind of parents. You know, I don't have one of those sort of tragic stories of being neglected, or I was unconditionally loved, you know. pretty much all my life. I had a very happy childhood. It's the kind of thing that sets you up. It's probably, I think, the greatest gift that anybody can give you. So I had all of the, I guess, weaponry, if you like, to survive pretty much anything. And yet I almost didn't with this. I almost sort of disappeared into that black hole and never came out again.
Your character Michael has a very public expression of emotional outpouring at one point. His breakdown is a very public one, and it's a very graphic one. And I wondered if you wanted to reflect on how men reach a stage of expressing emotion.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Big emotion.
In the book, he's sort of in the back of a police wagon trying to talk his daughter out of the police wagon when he suddenly has a brain snap and starts slamming at the cage to the point where his palms start bleeding and the police have to, you know, kind of arrest him effectively and drag him out of the out of the paddy wagon. And I think that's a kind of probably a I don't know, I'm reluctant to say a very male response because it could be a female response
too,
of course.
Yeah, I hate to
generalize, it's a bit. But I do think men tend to, you know, verbalize less emotionally. I mean, I think we tend to have a less complex emotional vocabulary with women. Women tend to talk more to each other about all the minutiae of stuff.
They form.
I like your shoes. I like your shoes. Where did you get those earrings? All that kind of stuff that don't really happen with blokes. It tends to be kind of bigger sort of action, more action type things that blokes do together. And, you know, I know I'm wildly generalizing here, but I think the great advantage of the way that women speak to each other is that they develop a very complex vocabulary. So when good things or terrible things happen to each other, they have a way of expressing it to each other, and therefore they're able to be there for each other. I think men don't really tend to develop the vocabulary. I feel kind of blessed in a way because I was raised by my mother and father, but my father died when I was 13, but also two older sisters who are very emotionally intelligent women. And so I grew up in a household where I observed this kind of dialogue and this kind of interaction.
You wrote it as a screenwriter of, you know, great eminence and talent. You know, you wrote these stories down. You wrote about that emotional.
Yes.
You brought emotional literacy to your scripts. Has writing effectively what is a tragicomedy, a novel, has writing it changed things? I mean, obviously, a lot of things changed for you. Going to a psychiatrist changed things.
Yes,
for you.
Yes, definitely. It's definitely changed things for me. It's interesting. I wrote the book thinking I was actually in Bristol at the time visiting my son. He was living there. I had 2 months. And I thought, I'm just going to kind of knock this story out because I really know, you know, I've been thinking about it for quite a while. When I knocked it out, it really wasn't until I'd knocked it out that I thought, why did I do that? Why did I need to tell this story? It's past, it's whatever. And I suddenly realized that I wanted to know why. Not why I fell down, I knew that, but why did I get back up again, you know? And I suppose what I bring from that frontier is that it's about the redemptive power of love, really, that, you know, without the love of your family and your friends and, you know, my children and my sisters and my wife, I couldn't have got back up again.
You did get back up again.
But I did, yay.
And Michael gets back up again too.
Here he does.
And it's a treat, actually. And thank you for coming on The Wireless and talking about all this.
It's been a great pleasure.
Because that's a genuine act of love, too. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks very much for having me.
Mark Lamprell. The Full Ridiculous.